Where's the beef?
Where's the beef? Where's the beef? I'll tell you where. It's back in the stacks of the NPR tape library. Last row on the right in the refrigerator aisle marked March 1984. I'm Kerry Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. And the funny thing about the NPR archives from 25 years ago is that you find the beef when you least expect it. We'll have the story of the advertising slogan that became the rallying cry of the 84 presidential campaign.
Where's the beef? Where's the beef?
And we'll have an interview with Jim Morris, a comedian who makes me do the audio equivalent of a double take.
A healthy economy is much like a balanced budget. Is like a balanced diet. A balanced budget is like a balanced diet. In one, we stay the course, and in the other, we eat the course.
There's nothing like a tasty impersonation of President Ronald Reagan. And in this podcast, the hits keep on coming. Actor John Malkovich reveals how he works his theatrical magic night after night.
I only always give about 50 or 60%, really. I don't know, I'm just sort of superstitious, but I think it's always good to hold back.
Now, how often do you hear an actor actually say that? And how often you get to think about important things, like the many charms of Bozo the Clown?
He's a symbol of love, he's a symbol of understanding, because that's really me, and I'm really two people. I'm both Bozo and myself.
Both Bozo and myself. Yeah, I feel like that sometimes, too. Anyway, it was a funky world out there 25 years ago, but we'll be your cruise directors here at Playback. First things first, the word yuppie. It's an unfortunate-sounding expression coined in the early 80s to describe young, upwardly mobile professionals. Newsweek magazine declared 1984 the year of the yuppie, and the presidential candidates that season were trying their hardest to find and capture the yuppie vote. But only Democrat Gary Hart was having much success. Here's NPR's Cokie Roberts.
Analysts have been waiting for this yuppie phenomenon to emerge on the political scene for quite some time, as University of Illinois political scientist and pollster Gerald Strom explains.
What you're talking about is this very large lump of people, which could be called the baby boom generation, all of a sudden getting to be in their 30s. And I suppose the oldest thing, it might be in their 40s, younger ones in the upper 20s. That's about when people start to vote in increasing numbers. Well, the baby boom generation, this big mass of people, are now moving into those age groups where they tend to vote.
The baby boom generation, those children born in the 15 years after World War II, has affected every aspect of American society, schools, housing, employment. But the political impact of this group hasn't been felt dramatically. But now the boom babies are going to the polls and looking for a candidate of their own. This 26-year-old who works for a Chicago leasing company has found one in Gary Hart.
The first candidate for the baby boom era, I guess, people of our age. I think we were obviously too young for McGovern. Some of us were still very close to just being over the voting age when Carter ran. Reagan was certainly not someone that a group of this type would rally around en masse.
Hart specifically geared his message to this group. That's what the whole theme of new ideas is all about. And these young people are buying it. As they rush off the elevated train in the Lincoln Park section of Chicago, almost all say they like Gary Hart.
Well, I think he's got a new approach to a lot of old ideas. And with Mondale, I think that he brings back a lot of the old Carter administration, and I did not agree with a lot of Carter's ideas.
When Gary Hart looks out at the electorate, he speaks to the Richard Blewitts, people political scientist Strom describes as economic conservatives but social liberals, meaning they're against government spending and restrictions on abortions, just the opposite from the blue-collar constituency that both Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan are vying for. But the number of blue-collar jobs is dropping daily, and now people that work in the heavy industries make up less than half the American workforce. Gerald Strom believes it's the children of these blue-collar workers, the yuppies, who could make the difference for the Democratic Party.
Hart might have a problem putting these socially conservative and socially liberal people together. But if he can do that, he would probably stand a very, very good chance, probably the best chance of beating Reagan at this point in time.
If the baby boom voters do stay put behind Gary Hart and find a home in the Democratic Party, they could create a new coalition that makes 1984 a watershed election. I'm Cokie Roberts in Chicago.
In March 84, the all-male Mississippi Senate finally did the right thing. They gave women the right to vote. Now, you might think, huh? Or, hmm? Women had been voting all along. It's just that the state hadn't officially ratified the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Senator Cy Rosenblatt introduced the amendment, and in the process, he got some attitude from his colleagues.
When I drafted the bill and walked the floor of the Senate to ask senators to sign on, some of the senators thought that this was a backdoor approach to the Equal Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. I had to assure them that this was not the case. When I walked around the third or fourth senator I talked to said, no, I can't sign that, and I didn't press him. Then around 2 days later, I was talking to someone real near him, and he heard me talking to him, and he saw that around 20 senators had already signed the bill, so he decided that he would sign on then, that the bill was legitimate, since all these other fellows had signed on to it.
I understand.
Matter of fact, he put his name right up there so he could be second on the list.
But you don't mean to be saying that there is some actual opposition in the state of Mississippi to women having the right to vote?
Well, no. Matter of fact, it was voted unanimously.
Well, has this issue come up every session in Mississippi, or has it been on the shelf?
Well, it's been on the shelf for a while, and I think a couple of years ago, they tried to bring it out again, and it passed the House of Representatives. And when it passed the House of Representatives, the newspapers in Jackson wrote an article making fun of the fact that Mississippi had not ratified the 19th Amendment. And in response to the hilarity of the situation that the press had pointed out, the Senate got upset, thinking that the press was making Mississippi look bad, so it refused to pass the 19th Amendment at that point. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I certainly understand that.
It doesn't make much sense that they did it, but they indeed did it.
The state of Mississippi may be a bit embarrassed by what's happened, but you can be no more embarrassed than Delaware must be.
We're very proud that we are 49th in this and not 50th. This is one of those rare occasions where we're not going to be at the bottom of the ladder in something.
Things that make you go,
When I check the Google, it tells me that Mississippi was the absolute last state to ratify the 19th Amendment, with Delaware having ratified it in 1920. And here's more progressive thinking, this time from the Mile High City of Denver, Colorado. Jim Aiken, the fellow who ran the St. Patrick's Day Parade, decided that he didn't want the gay and lesbian group to march.
We felt that they added nothing to the St. Patrick's Day Parade. They were merely there to display their sex preferences, and we didn't think it fit into a parade of this type. Small youngsters, parents, and that type of thing that watch it every year, and we felt that, they had ideas of wearing lavender shamrocks and going along with their lovers and all that disgusting type thing for our parade.
Mr. Aikens, the theme of the parade, I've heard, is St. Patrick's Day is for everyone.
Yes. We said that St. Patrick's Day is for everyone. We didn't say that parade was going to be for everyone.
Well, wouldn't it be fairer to say St. Patrick's Day is for everyone in Denver but homosexuals?
We've had to turn other groups down in the past that we didn't feel fit into the parade set up.
For example?
That were, too many Jeeps or cars or...
But that's a logistical problem.
Yeah.
Have you turned down minority groups in the past?
No. This is not a minority group, these homosexuals.
Let me make sure of your objection to the gay and lesbian group marching in the parade. Is it that you think they would set a bad example for the young people watching?
I think that's one of the things, and the other thing is I think it leads to a volatile situation. It's for their own protection probably, too.
How would it be volatile?
I'm not saying that all these Irishmen downtown that start the name-calling back and forth, you could get into a real Brannigan down there, you know.
Now, the mayor of Denver Federico Pena has sort of thrown up his hands about all this and said he wouldn't even attend the parade this year. What do you think about that?
What he's doing is he's starting on the premise that this is the main thing, the homosexual, not the bulk of the people in the community, the whole mass of people who are not homosexual. But if we start letting them in, what would be next? Nudist, Hell's Angels, all those kind of groups?
And now for the story you've been patiently waiting for, reported for us by Andy Lyman.
I've come back into the race because people ask the one question that counts the most. Where's the beef? Where's the beef?
With even Walter Mondale invoking the question, where's the beef, Seth Siegel is a very happy man. He works for Hamilton Projects, and they are the ones who license the rights or give permission to use the Wendy's hamburger phrase, where's the beef?
We've done movies, and we've done corporations, and we've done celebrities, and we've done books, and we've done TV shows. But this is the very first time ever that any licensing organization has been involved in the licensing of a phrase from a television advertisement. And this, in its own way, is marketing and licensing history. This phrase will be with us at least through the Democratic Convention this summer. I don't think there can be any doubt about that. And I suspect that it's going to be part of the political jargon right through Election Day. So we certainly, what Walter Mondale has given us is longevity.
And what Wendy's gave us is an unforgettable catchphrase and a pretty funny commercial.
It certainly is a big bun.
It's a very big bun.
Big fluffy bun.
It's a very big fluffy bun.
Where's the beef?
Some hamburger places give you a lot less beef on a lot of bun.
Where's the beef?
At Wendy's, we serve a hamburger we modestly call a single. And Wendy's single has more beef than the Whopper or Big Mac. At Wendy's, you get more beef and less bun.
Hey, where's the beef? I don't think there's anybody back there.
You want something better. You're Wendy's kind of people.
You want something better? You got it. Because I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. More beef and less bun. In 1984, it appears that the body politic could not get enough of President Reagan, real or otherwise. Here's comedian Jim Morris impersonating Reagan at a mock press conference.
Merrily we roll. Yes.
Well, what's the future of your Lebanon policy?
The future of my Lebanon policy, well, suffice it to say that we had to, well, we weren't bugging out like some of them suggested we had. What we did was we just withdrew to we didn't withdraw. What we did was we pulled back. We didn't pull back. We ran away.
I just go out there with my own brand of political humor, which is I adopt the guise of the president and use him as my vehicle for my political commentary. But it's disguised. People, you can't shove it down their throats. I couldn't go on stage and editorialize, as I say, because people don't. They want to be entertained. So I go out there with my Reagan impression, and for the first few moments, I'm establishing character, giving that old
folksy grin and that little twinkle in my eye, and until they accept me, and then they forget that it's an actor playing Reagan, and they just fall right in line.
In the light of your age, what do you have to say to those people who question your continued ability to be president?
Well, let me just say that I'm not too old to be president. Absolutely not. My doctor examined me just the other day, and he looked up at me, and he said to me, Ron, you.
The part that the audience can't see, this audience, is the visual treatment you give the president, and that is very convincing. You do something with your eyes, something with your whole face.
It's a state of mind, it really is, and I have to have friends of mine rescue me. When I get off stage, I'm just a mess.
Come back.
Yes. Yeah, right.
Ish.
Yeah, what do you have to say about Mondale saying that you govern by amnesia?
Walter Mondale saying that I govern... He said that I govern by amnesia? It's funny, I don't remember him saying that.
Next question, please. When will you balance the budget?
Well, we're just gonna... When are you gonna shut up? Ask me next December.
You work a lot of 50s into the bit.
Well,
a lot of things
funny.
You remember from 50s.
What I do is I just say, what has Reagan lived through? Mm-hmm. What has he learned about history? And I just incorporate all the givens into this bank of information that I can draw on. What about the budget?
Well, we have a problem there. We have to balance the budget, and a healthy economy is much like a balanced budget. Is like a balanced diet. A balanced budget is like a balanced diet. In one, we stay the course, and in the other, we eat the course. Now, the first course is a horse, of course, but no one can talk to a horse. You see, that's like a trigger. So anything that... Trigger, and I.O. Silver and Trigger and Roy Rogers and 20 Mule Dame Borax.
And so, like, I'm just going back into his old nostalgia thing. If people think about the things, the issues that I bring up, well, that's great.
Larry, can I tell them about our new jobs program? Well, the Democrats, those doomsayers and misery merchants and hand-wringers and doubting Thomases and bad boy boys, they claim that I don't have a viable jobs program. Well, our jobs program will be premiering on ABC this fall. Be called Real Poor People.
Comedian Jim Morris. And following that story about the star of the movie Bedtime for Bonzo, we present an actual interview with Bozo the Clown. Larry Harmon, one of the original Bozos, showed up to talk to Bob Edwards about his curious No Bozos ad campaign.
I've always had a something that I've come up with called a Bozo No-No. Anytime anybody's ever done anything live on our show, and that's before there was tape, well, they do something wrong, well, you have no chance of doing it. You have no tape, it's live. I'd always say, you know, that's a, that's a Bozo No-No. So it grew out of that. I don't mean there should be no more Bozos, and I don't mean there's no more clowns. The purpose of what I've done with this is that I've taken a double negative, and I've made it a positive. I took the symbol Bozo with a red, white, and blue beautiful Bozo face, put it in the middle of the circle with a line through it, this international signal, and what I'm really saying, or Bozo's really saying, is do something good for yourself and something good for other people too. Don't do drugs. Don't smoke. Don't drink. Wouldn't it be great if everybody in the whole world, especially in our country, had a little No Bozo sign on the mirror in their bathroom? Wouldn't it be great just before each day when we go out and they look in the mirror and they see it, before they go to school or to work, wherever it is, thinking of doing something good. Just one little thing good that day. What a better world we'd have, wouldn't we, Bob?
Well, if I hadn't heard your explanation, I would have interpreted that sign to say that there shouldn't be a Bozo.
Yes. You know, that is a major problem.
But despite that problem, Harmon seems pleased with his No Bozo campaign. Larry Harmon truly believes in Bozo.
He's a symbol of love. He's a symbol of understanding. He's a symbol of honesty, of frankness, of believability. He's all these wonderful things. Well, I realize that because that's really me, and I'm really two people. I'm both Bozo and myself. I always had a feeling all my life of helping people, of doing something good for people. It was always a dream. I love this country. I love the people in it. They've given me so much for so many years, and I desperately want to give so much back to them.
Larry Harmon, the original Bozo the Clown. This morning at the National Press Club here in Washington, D.C., Larry Harmon is scheduled to announce that he is a candidate for the presidency of the United States.
And I would like to leave you one thing, if I may, and that's what everybody has heard all over the world. And that's when Bozo goes off the air every day, as he has for almost 40 years on television, when he says, just remember what your old pal Bozo always says. Just keep laughing. So long, Bob. So long.
Not much is written about Bozo's actual run for president in 84. We're going to assume he didn't win. At least, we're pretty sure he didn't. Unless he showed up later in the form of some other political figure. March 84 witnessed the ascent of actor John Malkovich. He was chewing up the scenery on Broadway as Biff in Death of a Salesman. He talked to NPR's Jay Kernis.
Out of all the plays I've done, it's by far the hardest thing for me to do. I mean, it would perhaps not be so hard for other actors, but for me, I find it very hard, you know, and I've probably done maybe 70 or 80 plays.
Do you know what makes it hard?
Yeah, it's very serious and it's kind of unrelenting. He almost totally lacks irony, you know, which is sort of one of the few qualities I understand.
During rehearsals, did you ever allow yourself to think, Arthur Miller is sitting somewhere in the house?
The usual time when I think that is when I start arguing with him about something. About 5 minutes into it, I'll say something really vehement, and then I'll realize that he wrote it. I want it to be good for him. It has helped me, I know, and I think it's helped Dustin enormously to have him around in rehearsals. And a very interesting kind of thing happens with him is that you do almost forget, and he sort of almost forgets, that he wrote the play. He can be very objective about it.
Do you have anything left when you step off stage?
Yeah, I only always give about 50 or 60%, really. I don't know, I'm just sort of superstitious about it. I think it's always good to hold back because, see, when I look at the run of a play, I think we're not even halfway through it. Months from now, I'm still going to be doing this play. You know, and eight times a week, I don't think it's terribly wise to invest yourself emotionally in a play like this eight times a week, always.
Do you know what the 100% feels like, or the 80%?
For a few seconds at a time, I do. If you can, you know, beat a guy to the baseline half speed, why are you going to go full speed? People who say, I think, that they don't think about what a critic will say or how they'll be accepted, or they're either so intelligent that I really envy them, or, you know, they're just really not being totally truthful. I mean, I hope the play succeeds. I hope I'm well received in it. But I will say this, and it's the same thing I've always said. I am very arrogant, and I only really care what I think. And that's how I've always been since I was 2 or 3 years old. I'm challenging myself. I'm not challenging Dustin or the Washington Post or the New York Times. I'm really in it for myself.
And we wouldn't have it any other way. Actor John Malkovich's 50 or 60% was apparently enough. Later that year, he was nominated for an Oscar for his work in the 1984 film Places in the Heart. And if you are wondering who this land belongs to, look no further. Here's NPR's Noah Adams.
The songs by Woody Guthrie were sometimes sad but never sorrowful. He wrote prideful songs for common folks, more than 1,000 songs, and many of them will surely stay with us. Woody Guthrie died in New York City in the hospital in 1967, a victim of Huntington's disease. There's a documentary about the life of Woody Guthrie being shown this month on public television. One of the producers, Woody's 36-year-old son, Arlo Guthrie.
I remember as a kid going out to Okemah, Oklahoma, and visiting what had been my dad's house.
You talked with a lot of the people in Okemah this time. Do they understand? I mean, he was their person and he's gone. How do they feel about him now?
Well, that was one of the interesting things. We really didn't know how people were going to feel about being intruded upon by a film crew to talk about a person who, at one time or another, might have been controversial. We walked in, the cameras were going, the mics were on, we went into bars or wherever we went and talked to people and said, remember about Woody Guthrie? What do you think about him? Do you remember anything at all? Do you know who he was? And people were eager to answer or listen to explanations about him, and it was really great.
The dust storm that you have in your documentary, the real-life newsreel photograph, it's great.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful footage. It's scary.
Makes me understand, too, that the song for the first time, So Long It's Been Good to Know You, people leaving that part of the country and going off to do whatever they think they can.
So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along.
He was willing to let history take its course with him. He was willing to let the judgment come later. But he was going to be himself, whatever that meant. And that meant that he couldn't concentrate or spend a lot of time dealing with whether he was good or bad or right or wrong or this or that, but had to deal with the urgent necessity that he was confronted with, was how to make these homeless, kicked out people feel like they were really human beings, how to make them laugh, how to enjoy a little bit of time with their families, or to rekindle the things that they thought were important that they had maybe lost in the journey.
Is there one particular song when you perform it, or even just sit around the house and play and sing it, one song that brings you the closest to your father, the one song that makes you really feel in touch?
Well, strangely enough, I always had thought that This Land Is Your Land is actually a boring song. It was so simple, and I never really thought it was any great piece of literature. Funny, though, that when we did the movie itself, the time came to work on a soundtrack for it, and I decided that for the soundtrack, the way we did the end of the film works filmically, but actually wouldn't work on a record, which is all of these different people singing parts of This Land Is Your Land. And so I took the recording of him singing it, and I began to sing along with it. And suddenly the words didn't seem important anymore, and the tune didn't seem important, but there was a sense of presence, of his presence, that made it really kind of strange and weird to be there. And for the first time in my life, I found myself really listening to the song, not to the words, I already knew them, or the tune, but to how he was singing it and how he was actually phrasing it. I crawled in between the spaces of the words, and I discovered stuff in there that I'd just never heard before.
Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking my freedom highway. Nobody living can make me turn back. This land was made for you and me.
Thanks for joining us this month. And since our archives are your archives, check out the new NPR blog called As a Matter of Fact. It features the wit, wisdom, and vast institutional memory of our NPR librarians. Go to npr.org/blogs.
This land was made for you and me.
Special thanks this month to the creative team of Katziff and Spear, and a big boy howdy to all our loyal playback listeners out there in podcast land. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.